Yeah, okay. Hello, everybody. Happy Friday to you. Welcome to Tom and Curly Show. I am not Tom nor Curly. Those fellas are out today. Probably, I don't know, getting ready for St. Patrick's Day or something. Those two Irish fellas. Is that right, Jacob? Is that what they're doing?
I suppose. Yeah. That didn't occur to me.
That's my guess. I don't know.
Did anyone say, got it yet?
Got it! Not quite yet. In fact, you know what? We have some business to take care of. I'm here with Felix Manoah, of course. We'll get to the proper intro in just a second here because, as you know, as listeners to the Tom and Curly Show, everybody gets music. And I'm no stranger here. You might remember me from Cairo Nights a year ago and filling in occasionally, but I'm happy to be back on the show. Jacob, I have music and I want it. Will you give it to me?
Put me in cold. Yeah. I'm ready to play.
All right. Come on, Fogarty. Put me in, coach. This song is called Centerfield, apparently. Put
That's
me in,
right.
coach,
yeah,
in parentheses.
His big comeback from 1980, I don't know.
Kidding me.
80 clickety-clack.
It's like Escape, parentheses, the Pina Colada song. Same kind of deal. That is the voice, of course, of one Felix Bunnell. Felix! Let's get them tunes.
Felix the cat.
You
remember? Wonderful, wonderful.
It confuses people because for a while there, I demanded a different walk-on music because I don't know if you remember Tim Hake, who used to be a reporter
there
at Cairo Radio. He has, his is Baker Street, that whole song by Jerry Rafferty, which has that wonderful kind of, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I like that song, Year of the Cat by Al Stewart.
Okay.
Because it's kind of a subtle thing about Felix, even though my name's spelled differently, and Felix the Cat, you know, whatever.
She comes out of the sun.
There you go.
Okay.
I think why John hates it and why he eventually took it away is because the energy is kind of like,
you know what I was,
oh yeah,
that's exactly
wow.
what I was just going to say. Yeah. I'm happy with my song because at least the energy's good.
Yeah,
you know?
So I'll stick with whatever they give me.
Popping.
I can't choose. Who am I to choose?
Sean behind the board, Jacob producing. It's the rest of the crew. Heather's going to be here doing the news, like you know. And speaking of news, we should probably get to some here, Felix. I guess that's
yes,
why.
Yes, it's news. Yeah, news you can use or news is, I forget, what do they call it, a lighter side? They'll do it every time on the bright. What is it? What's the catchphrase for Tom and Curly? A fun look at the news?
Jacob?
We don't look at the
write
fun.
It? We do not have a formal catchphrase, I don't think.
It's a newsy look at the fun, isn't it? Yeah, newsy look at the fun.
Newsy look at the fun. All right, let's talk about it. Vaccine tourism, vaccine vacations, as people are calling them, now that the COVID-19 vaccine is available, although in a somewhat limited capacity, depending on where you are and who you are, looks like some people are finding excuses to jump the line. Here is Cairo 7's Allison Grandy.
Some people are tired of waiting for their turn to get vaccinated and are taking flight. Vaccine vacations are becoming big business with high demand for the COVID shot. NYU professor Arthur Kaplan says it's happening all over the world.
And I also know that people have gone to Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. Now, you have to be pretty rich and have a lot of free time to do it, but I know people have done it.
We found this website for zenithholidays.com based in India. They have a section for vaccine tourism. You enter your name, contact information, and when you want to travel. They send back an email with options.
They're taking the COVID panic and marketing it.
Steve Danishek owns TMA Travel in Seattle.
Medical tourism has been around for a long time. The idea of putting a package together, including the airfare, the hotel, whatever quarantines are necessary, and the shot, the vaccine.
This package to the UK for Valentine month has a 4-day stay. The flyer says the trips include airfare, breakfast, sightseeing, and a COVID safety kit. But they can't guarantee the price or availability of the vaccine. They're also selling trips from India to the United States. A 4-day stay with a vaccine for about $2,000. But the company warns they're still waiting on approval from the FDA.
I mean, this is what we do, isn't it, Felix?
Yeah, exactly.
This is you see a market and you capitalize on it. I'm going to withhold my moral reservations for just a second here, but does it frustrate you?
Well, you know, I'm in my early 50s, so I'm probably like 2 years away from getting vaccine probably at this point. Back in January, there was a Thursday night I heard from a friend at about 10:45 that the freezer broke down. There's 5,000 doses at Northwest Hospital up in North Seattle. My wife and I drove up there. Turned out there were 5,000 doses, but they'd been spread out around a bunch of different hospitals, so there were only a few hundred there. We waited in line for like till 1 in the morning.
Wow.
it was like waiting for concert tickets or something.
Yeah, I remember
it was
that.
Kind of, it was the sort of high spirits, and it wasn't raining or anything. But, you know, we ended up going home empty-handed, and it felt like we got so close.
Yeah.
So with the notion that the vaccine is going to be here very soon for pretty much anyone of any age who wants it, it's just it's so tempting to want to jump the line.
Yeah, sure.
Especially if you have the money, if you can afford it. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, ethically, this seems like this is probably challenged somewhat, right?
Let's talk about ethically.
Now, whether you have a friendly pharmacist that's going to help you out for an extra few $100, that's kind of a gray area. Maybe it's legal, maybe it's not. It's certainly not ethical, but it is being done.
At Seattle University, Professor Jeffrey Smith urges caution. Just because it's an option doesn't mean you should book it.
And that's where, as I tell my students, sort of ethics is sort of being respectful of the things that can't be enforced.
In situations like this, I'm always reminded of Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park and his wonderful line of, your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Yeah.
And I feel there are people who are in need. You heard it in Heather's newscast. There are elderly people who are concerned that they're nowhere near being able to get the vaccine and to make sure that they're safe, and people with underlying pre-existing conditions and all that, all those high risk groups. And the fact that you can shell out a couple bucks, I know that's how the world works. I've heard that. But does that mean it should?
No, it shouldn't work that way. But there'll always be some small, I think it's a small percentage of the population, mm-hmm. who could take advantage of this because they have the resources,
right,
and because they lack the ethics, and who will take advantage of it.
Right.
But it's such a small part. I think on the whole, again, maybe I'm a Pollyanna about this. On the whole, I think most of the distribution will be, if not well organized, at least ultimately equitable. But the fact you have to wait in line for it when it's there and you know people are getting it is just really, it's really strange. I mean, I saw Contagion 5 or 6 times, one
sure.
of my favorite movies.
Yeah, great movie.
And they covered this. I think didn't Lawrence Fishburne, when he felt bad because he'd given
yes.
advance notice to a relative to get out of town.
Yes.
And then later he gave his vaccine to the family with the
Matt
janitor
Damon's
who
family.
Worked at, the, yeah, no, it was the janitor who worked there at the CDC had young kids or something,
oh,
and
right.
Lawrence
yeah,
Fishburne
yeah, yeah,
gave
yeah,
his
right.
dosage to that family to kind of make up for it. So, I mean, these are weird times, right? And I always feel like these are the times to go big and like do big gestures, big, whether it's bold gestures that are ethical, of course. I'm not saying go big on crime or on sleaze,
yeah.
but go big and do stuff that when you look back 5, 10, 20 years from now, or when your kids or your grandkids tell the story about what you did in 2020 and 2021, that'll be a really cool story that people will be, wow, that's amazing what they did. I haven't done, I've done nothing like that myself so far. I mean, I think I picked up some groceries for a neighbor, but beyond that, I haven't done some big major,
mm-hmm.
Stretch to try to help people during the
yeah.
pandemic. And I feel bad about that. But,
well, listen, I mean, big altruistic moves are kind of tough when everybody is so strapped. You know, there's a lot of people struggling a lot right now, and it's hard to get out and do that extra thing or go that extra mile when you're just trying to keep, everything in your life or your orbit, your family together. And that brings us to the next thing that we should talk about here, which is this COVID relief that's happening right now. Senators are votes been delayed. They're going to figure out what in the world they're supposed to do here. Democrats are I guess, wrangling over details here. It looks like extra unemployment benefits. This, of course, is all part of this $1.9 trillion relief package they're trying to put out. Democrats, I guess they've settled on some last minute agreement here for like $300 extra in unemployment. That's down from $400 that was originally passed by the House. They're trying to figure out how long is this thing going to go. I don't know. Relief aside for a second, I just want to get a tiny bit political. I generally don't enjoy doing that, but I'm gonna. I'm so mad at the Democrats. Like, why is it that every time there's some sort of whenever I hear bipartisan agreement, what registers in my brain is, well, the Democrats lost whatever ground they were trying
yeah.
to gain.
Yep.
I mean, it's insanity. I don't know. Where are you at with this, Felix?
Well, I mean, during the Obama years, he was famously talked about how he was going to, meet the Republicans halfway and everything, and just all that failed because they were just out to shut down any legislation he attempted to pass.
Right, right.
Especially
right.
once the Senate had the majority of the Senate, and then they lost the House eventually, too. I think Biden is cagier than that, and he's got cagier people around him working the legislative side of it since he was in the Senate for 47 years or whatever it was. So I think this notion that Biden is just sort of playing it cool, I think they will ultimately get a lot of what they want. But I think the process is just kind of ugly. And I think we're paying way more attention to legislation and to, you know, this single senator like Joe Manchin,
right.
the moderate Democrat. That guy has so much power right now, where in a previous time, or if this time hadn't been preceded by a really wacky 4 years of the Trump administration, where the Republican Senate was pretty much, you know, doing only what the Republican Senate wanted to do, we wouldn't be paying this much attention. We'd just be sort of, we'd be hearing updates, but we're hearing like minute by minute, especially yesterday when they went through that 10 or 12 hours of reading the bill out loud. And now because of the, and it's so in the weeds, this notion of the of a filibuster where you have to have 60 votes to get something to pass versus whether you have 50 plus one with Kamala Harris coming in to give the Democrats a majority. This Votorama, I think that is that happening yet? Do we know, is a Votorama actually underway where if something's going to be passed by just the narrowest majority possible, what they call reconciliation, the opposition party has the chance, or the minority party has the privilege of floating all these crazy amendments just so they can make the Democrats or the majority party look bad for voting either against, you know, against puppies or in favor of, you know, beating up old ladies or whatever. There are all these really bizarre things. Has that actually started? Do you know, is Votorama underway?
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I read something that said the Votorama had happened, but that was, I think that might be a very, very recent development.
It's been a great class, like a 400-level class in constitutional democracy in terms of all the things. But the multiple impeachments have been fabulous. What a great way to see how that worked. I mean, I could lead an impeachment. If I had to be a House manager of impeachment, I think I could do it.
You could do it. You've seen enough.
I've seen it twice in a year, so it's very easy. And then now this notion of the filibuster and the Votorama and stuff, it's just... I know way more about this than I did when I was studying, like reading the Constitution in, you know, whatever, seventh grade or whatever it was, or 12th grade.
But with everybody paying so much attention to it, don't you think the Democrats would be more concerned with optics than it seems that they are? I mean, they have some pretty heavy campaign. There was the $2,000 to everyone right away. That turned into, like, well, $1,400. And then, like, maybe by March, $1,400. And then, like, well, maybe, but it might not. Like, don't they understand what's happened? And don't they know about the historical precedents here, that if you make big campaign promises and then don't follow through on any of them, you lose this razor-thin majority that you have? It just doesn't make any sense to me why they wouldn't be more vocal about it.
I think they're playing a longer game, and I think we're recovering from an era where it wasn't about kind of the ugly, not ugly, but the kind of the part of government, the legislation and the stuff, the day-to-day really boring stuff that the media can't really cover because it doesn't really, you can't really cover it unless you're just watching C-SPAN wall to wall. We're coming off an era where the president, you know, whether you love or hate President Trump, it was all about just reacting to things and throwing, you know, throwing verbal grenades or written grenades via Twitter to get people to react about stuff. And it was this constant, I think it's primed us to want this constant flow of provocation or something. And this is like, this is just how legislation's supposed to work. It looks like it's going to go one way for a while. You get half of what you want, you get two thirds of what you want, you get whatever. But ultimately, you make some kind of progress and both parties find something that they can agree on. And that's going to be relatively, not new, but it'll be sort of a return to the way Congress worked when nobody was paying attention, you know, 25 years ago.
Right. A little bit of normalcy.
I don't know if voter. So I was trying to get an answer to this Votorama question, whether or not it's happening. Yeah. So according to C-SPAN, the voting has been delayed due to negotiation on the next COVID bill vote. So I don't know if Votorama has already happened. I would presume that they have taken a break to strategize ahead of Votorama.
Intermission, right, exactly. Votorama, act two break.
But just so you know. You
get Votorama two.
Go get your pinky.
Electric Boogaloo, yes. Yeah.
Did you say Electorate Boogaloo?
Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Breaking two.
I thought you made
the whole sequel to Breaking.
Of course.
Yeah. Electorate Boogaloo, that's a better joke. Yeah, thank you for
Electorate Boogaloo. I try.
Oh.
Yeah,
wow,
see?
That's, whoa.
This,
see what is saying, that, we doing? Are we doing a radio show or a newsletter right now? What are we doing?
I don't, you know, honestly, I'm not sure. Glad I can string two sentences together after not talking to anybody for like 6 months.
Yeah, me too.
Very, very exciting.
What have you been doing? Where have you been lately? I mean, is that a secret? Are you like,
no,
hiding
I've been,
out in prison
been,
or something?
I've been home, man.
Okay.
I pretty much haven't gone anywhere. I get out and about a little bit. There's a bar close to me that is open that sometimes in the afternoons I'll head over there and just sort of sit somewhere else. If it's, and I'm usually the only one there, which is pretty exciting. Wow. It's like Norman Cheers status almost at this point. Yeah, but just you know, working on things here and there, struggling, man. I mean, it's really difficult out there, and that's where the extra little bit of anything really makes such a huge difference in people's lives. I know for a lot of folks out there, maybe a couple $100 doesn't mean much to you, but even if you're somebody who, you know, that's a very close to being where you need to be, just having that weight taken off your shoulders frees you up to think. That extra stress really does damage to folks. And so I hope we can figure out how to take care of each other a little better. It seems that some other countries around the world have been doing very well at it, or a lot better than us, and I hope we take the cue and see the results there.
Yeah, and if there ever was a time to spend big on federal money and drive the deficit far higher, regardless of your political beliefs, now's the time to do it. This is hit the emergency button.
It's also time for Tracy Taylor to talk a little traffic.
Mace!
What's up, Tracy? How you doing, girl?
Mace!
Come on.
It's been a minute. It has. I haven't talked to Felix since last time you filled in, so there you go.
Thanks. Thanksgiving.
Really? Has it been that long?
Something like that.
Okay, all right. Well, it's good to have you both here.
Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show here on Cairo Radio. Aaron Mason here with Felix Bunnell filling in for Tom and Curly. Felix, we got some. You're a historian.
Yes.
By trade, is that a fair phrase?
Oh,
or just
call myself
deep lifelong interest.
You know, exactly. I couldn't think of anything else to do. I ran out of other ideas. I would have loved to have been a doctor, you know, psychologist,
sure.
Engineer. Mm-hmm. I couldn't mm-hmm. hack anything. The math was hard for me. So.
Math is hard. I'm not gonna disagree with you there. Math is really hard. Sean Dottori, keep your ears open because we're about to talk about a story here that features pinatas.
Ah,
and I know you have a love. Have you been doing any pinata-ing? I don't know what the verb is.
Yeah, actually, just a couple of weeks ago, I helped our good friend Rachel Bell make her pinata because I am a pinata master. So, yeah.
Is there a pinataist? A pinato? I wonder if there's.
Yeah, I think the singular is pinato.
That's the male pinata.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Felix, let's talk about the story here, the history that we're living now.
Yeah, it's this article in the Wall Street Journal that covers how a lot of museums are actually actively collecting during the pandemic, which is very different from what happened back in 1918. You know, that was if you do any plunging into the history of the 1918 influenza pandemic, I mean, it was catastrophic, right? Mm-hmm. Something like 675,000 people died in the U.S., millions of people died around the world. There was not as great understanding of the science behind it, and it was just devastating for the world. But for some reason, there's not a lot of great artifacts or materials. I know I used to work at MOHAI, the Museum of History and Industry here in town. And I think in the MOHAI collection, there's maybe three photographs related to the pandemic. And you see them used over and over again, or used to before this current pandemic. The picture of a nurse, a picture of police wearing masks. Mm-hmm. Because they just weren't collecting that stuff, either because, I don't know, that kind of history wasn't really deemed worthwhile. There was nothing heroic about it. There was nothing sort of grand or glorious about it, the way there are about sort of wartime artifacts or even, you know, stuff about the Great Depression, which was people overcoming the economic hardship. So museums have been very consciously, since almost the get-go, I remember even a year ago, I think, museums are actively asking people to save things like masks or save things like, you know, any kind of correspondence related to the pandemic, because they want to do a much better job telling the story next time around. There's a place in my furnace closet where I've been sticking. You know, you got that weird mailer about, I don't know, 9 or 10 months ago from the government that had like the update about the pandemic, and it had something like information from President Trump about the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I put that up on this little ledge over part of my furnace. I got something from the King County Health Department. That one up there too.
Yeah.
Kind of have this little treasure trove of paper goods from the pandemic that either I'll discover at some point and throw it away, or long after I'm gone, somebody will be cleaning the furnace and will find that stuff and be treated to a little 2020 time capsule. But when I worked at MOHAI, there was one other big event while I was there where we actually actively collected material from, like back in it was the Nisqually earthquake back in 2001.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was that, you know, everybody experienced that. Everybody who was living here spent that, you know, experienced the minute or so of shaking and then the several days of aftermath and everything. So I think we got stuff like pieces of rubble from some of the buildings in Pioneer Square. The coolest thing that we were able, somebody actually called and offered our curator, and she said yes.
I don't know if you remember. I don't know if you were here 20 years ago.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, alongside the old, was the kingdom? The kingdom was still there? No, kingdom was gone.
Kingdom was
but
gone.
Along where the kingdom used to stand, there were all these brick buildings, and cars would park there to do set up stuff for some, it was like a floral show or something going on at the Stadium Exhibition Center. And this big 14-passenger van was crushed by a big pile of bricks. And someone offered that to the museum. And we said yes. I mean, I say we. The curator said yes. And I remember for the one-year anniversary of that quake, we actually had it on display out in front of the old museum there in Montlake. And it was really terrifying to see just how flat a big, what had been a big, probably, I don't know, 7-foot-tall van was flattened down to maybe 18 inches, something like that, by, you know, several tons of bricks or whatever.
Oh, sure.
So these museums, they're trying to just be able to tell the experience of everyday people. And I have no doubt that 10, 20, 100 years from now, there'll be so much material, you know, digital video, digital audio, blogs, who knows what else, social media, of course, that will let people understand what the everyday experience of this pandemic, what it was. Museums tend to err on the side, at least in the old days, used to tend to err on the side of collecting the more rarefied. Like one of the issues we had when I was still working for the museum was over the years, curators back in the 50s and 60s had said yes to old rich people who were either downsizing or planning to die or whatever. And they had a grand piano they had to get rid of.
Right.
So we had something like a dozen big pianos that were, you know, probably shipped here from Cincinnati or someplace, had no connection to local history.
Right.
And I think they've since gotten rid of most of them. But that was the kind of thing they collected. So this belonged to a rich person. So it's interesting. So, but meanwhile, we have probably nothing that tells the story of somebody in, you know, the 1940s experiencing home front deprivation because of wartime rationing and stuff. So.
See, I'm a huge fan of this because I think that a lot of the stuff that interests me, like when I look at old photos or see old videos, there's a subreddit that's dedicated to the way we were on video, and I'll go look at that, and it's just video from 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and looking in the background and just seeing the things that people are wearing. Or you look through old photo albums, and sometimes the most interesting thing is like what car Grandpa had, you know, and that was never really the focus, and you'd never think to save a picture of his car, but all of that stuff really helps fill in the blanks and make a whole complete textured picture. And that includes things like, Sean, I promised, the pinata. There is a place called Casa de Pinatas in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this woman, Leslie Kim, she just started making some pinatas. And they look like COVID. They're the little round things. They have them sticking out. And people love it. Because, of course, you get to take out a little bit of aggression.
Yeah.
You know,
and,
you know,
making a pinata in the shape of a sphere, mm-hmm. such as the COVID-19, that's such an easy pinata to make. And
Sean Paul Ranko, he's like easy peasy lemon squeezy.
Yeah, but I think that I was going to say that, I guess, thankful to COVID that it's so easy to make a pinata out of it.
Finally, COVID did something good.
Finally. Thanks, COVID.
Wherever you can get it. But I think this is very interesting, and this is the stuff that, you know, you look back at that, let's say, stuff from the Depression or anything in a museum. Like you were saying, Felix, it is usually the sort of big or important stuff or stuff of what would generally be considered significance. And I'm a bigger fan of that insignificant stuff. Yeah, what were the masks like that people were wearing? Maybe 100 years from now, fingers crossed we all make it. Maybe 100 years from now that we'll look back and go like, oh yeah, you had to put things over your face. You couldn't just, you know, put that drop in your eye or sniff that thing and it all went away like it does today. And we would never think that. You know, you can't look into the future, so you don't know that it's going to be important. I think it's cool. And that, like that literature you were saying, things that the government hands out, that you get, that sort of shows, like, here's what we know about this stuff so far, I think is super cool.
And what's unusual is that it's being displayed now. That's one thing. Some museums that are open that are displaying history as it's going on right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they were doing that during the Depression or during World War II or during the Cold War necessarily.
Right.
And, you know, with the earthquake thing 20 years ago, I'm pretty sure it was a one-year anniversary. But this period, this last 11, 13 months or so, as we've been living through it, I've been paying attention to it and collecting little bits of things. But I always think, like, oh my God, I don't want to ever think about this ever again. It's like most of the work I do with history, I'm digging up stories from 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, periods I didn't necessarily live through or didn't really remember very well. But this one, I'm like, oh God, if I ever do a story about the history of this COVID time 10, 20 years from now, it's going to be a real, like, it's going to be a real icky experience.
Well, go ahead, Jacob.
One of the things you're the master of, Felix, I feel like, is radio history in particular. Is there anything about the broadcast environment of the COVID era that really appeals to you, or think that is worth? I mean, to me, it's mainly just the fact that the remote broadcasts are so technically inefficient, and it leads to so many awkward moments. That would be a great montage if anyone has the time.
Well, the main thing, the fill-in hosts are just so bad. That's the one thing. But aside from the talent or lack thereof, no, the fact that not so much radio, but the fact television has become like radio, in that anyone with a computer can now be on TV, where in the past, anyone with a phone could be on the radio, and that gave radio this leg up over live coverage or live reaction from people. TV has now matched radio and being able to connect with people anywhere instantly who have internet connections. So I love that the quality level has dropped down technically and that anyone could go on anywhere now. That's pretty cool. So.
Well, we'll do
work
have
on
some...
the talent part more in the next hour.
Speaking of talent, let's talk to her. Tracy Taylor, how the road's looking out there?
Good one. Ooh, Mace. Gosh, you're buttering me up better than my husband. Look at that.
Tom and Curly Show, back at you. Cairo Radio, back at you. Just like...
yeah, back at you. Afternoon drive.
Hey, everybody. Aaron Mace and Felix Budell here with you.
Felix, such a zoo. You are such a crazy guy, Aaron. What are you going to say next? Everyone's just hanging on the edge of their seat.
I was listening to John's ad that they just played, and he just has that wonderful zing-songy voice about things.
Yeah.
It just sounds so good, and then I come on, and it's like, hi, guys. Hey, having fun?
But you're not trying to make someone buy a house or buy anything. You're selling yourself right now. Everyone's buying. If you read the text line, everyone's buying.
Everyone's buying. You know what I'm not reading? The text line. Thanks for shielding me from that, Jacob. Always appreciate it. I'm going to play a little clip. You asked me what we were going to get to. Here's a little clip. I'll tell you what it is in just a second. Now, no, that is not the reaction from people when they found out that Tom and John were not here today. And that you
I thought
and I
they're
be
outtakes
in.
From one of John's commercials for Keel Morgan's.
Yeah, that's right. It's a curly outtake. The curly outtake. That is actually a potentially, maybe, a test for COVID. There is, you know, the tests that we have now are those swabs that you have to shove way, way up into your nasal cavity. It's pretty quick, but it's pretty uncomfortable. As well. So there's a Dutch inventor. His name, I believe, is pronounced Peter van Wees. He invented this COVID test machine that all you have to do is get in there and scream. And here's a little clip of him talking about it.
If you are spreading and yelling and screaming, you're spreading tens of thousands of particles which contains the coronavirus. And if I take out the moisture from that coronavirus, I will have the basic coronavirus by itself, and therefore it can be recognized as such.
What do you think? What do you think, Felix?
It's nice that he always has background music playing behind him when he talks. It makes him seem much more professional, like much more highly produced.
That's the invention he's actually famous for, is the music that follows you around.
Well, I was reading the article. I was confused. Like, it says it takes 3 minutes. I assume you don't have to scream and yell for 3 minutes, right? You yell for some period of time, then it takes 3 minutes to get a result?
I certainly hope not, because I don't know if you've seen my lungs lately, but they're not in the shape that they once were.
You know, I've done one COVID test, a drive-through one so far. It was over at the Montlake parking lot there, a place parking lot I used to escape from when I went to the UW, but I didn't have 65 cents, and I'd get behind a car that did have money, and the guy would pay his money, the gate would go up, and I'd speed behind him and get out. So it was a real return to the scene of the crime for me, but it was much more somber.
My whole family went.
We all took turns jamming the Q-tip up in our nose, and it was really. I was worried that I wasn't pushing it far enough up, but I thought I might actually puncture into my brain and release fluid out of my head. But,
they give you the swab at that place?
Yeah, they do that now.
Oh, they gave it to me anyway. I don't know if that's a
deal. They don't trust me apparently with the swabs.
Would you?
I don't really want to do it to myself, so that's better.
But, you know, the result was posted some night, I don't know, at some point overnight. It was online maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 hours later, which seemed pretty fast.
Oh, yeah.
And it was negative, thank goodness. But
anything that makes it faster. If it really only takes 3 minutes to scream or whatever, or sing and know that you're positive or negative, that's great. But the part of it seems like it's snake oil. There's part of this guy, he just seems like he's just selling a bunch of crap. Don't you think?
Yeah, I have my concerns. I mean, at the very least, it's therapeutic more than maybe an accurate medical procedure. You just get in there and yell a little bit.
Yeah,
I don't
primal
know.
Scream therapy.
I don't know if I would feel comfortable. I don't know exactly what his sanitization processes are, but I'm not about to like cram into a phone booth that someone was just in yelling for 3 minutes. That doesn't necessarily make me very comfortable. But look,
that's a really good point.
The Dutch can work miracles. So who knows? Maybe I don't know. I'm a fan of the Dutch. What do you got?
I'll stick with the cuter. You can do a drive-through screaming booth. They could stick the microphone into your car on the end of a boom mic.
No, Tracy, no.
No. Hey, I don't know. When's the last time you guys said you got a COVID test?
Mine was in January. Yeah. January 20th or something like that.
Mine's been a few months.
So the one down here in South King County in Auburn, I believe now they make you blow your nose. And then they take a swab to the inside of your nose. They don't. And you guys, I think it's so funny that you're like, it's so painful. It's so far. It's really not that far.
I got jammed then.
I'll say
clearly somebody didn't like you. That's
possible.
I think it truly does depend on the well, for me, it's the firefighter that is tasked with doing it to me. And some of them that really, really feel like they've got to keep it in there for the 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And they're counting it out. One time the guy was like, I'll just keep counting for a couple more just to be safe. And it's like,
oh my God.
Guy's nope. So unnecessary.
Get rid of that guy.